The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Thanks, Carissa.
Team.
Y'all, how you doing? It's good. Go Braves. Yeah, I had no idea that the Braves won. I'm going to be really honest. It's not my thing. I overheard someone talking about Kyle making the decision to go to the game last night. That's not why he's here. He's actually preaching somewhere right now, which is really mind-boggling. Like, I don't know. He might fall down, like, halfway through the sermon. I shouldn't throw him under. Anyway, that's not me. I am the guy who I read Dune last week, so that way I could see the movie and still keep my nerd card. Like, that's me. I try to bring balance to the team. Like, Kip dabbles in nerdness a little bit, I think mostly for my behalf, but, like, I'm all there. Like, you name the thing, except for LARPing, and that's me. And if you don't know what LARPing is, you're fine. Like, you're going to live just fine. Just know it's pretty extreme, even for me. Anyway, if anyone LARPs, I'm sorry. Gosh, that went sideways. My name is Nathan, as Kip had said. I'm one of the pastors on the team most of the time. Nowadays, I find myself down in Simpsonville, where my family worships. I have 3 kids right now. I say right now, not because we've lost some along the way, but because we also foster, and so that number kind of varies. But right now, they are, Augustine is 7, Emma is 9, and Maddie is 11. And a quick rundown, Maddie is my sweet, complicated little girl, who's a soccer player and will never wear a dress. Like, we were playing Truth or Dare yesterday, and I said, I dare you to wear a dress. And she looked at me and was like, nope. And so that's Maddie. She's all soccer and Under Armour. And then there's Emma, and Emma is the opposite of Madeline. It's the way the second children go, you're right? Like, she is, like, all dresses, all the time, dance, perfectionist, adorable, needs to be the center of attention, overachiever. That's my sweet Emma. And boy, oh boy. And then there's August. What can I say about my son? If you were to take the nerdness of me and put him into the gooberness of a 7-year-old, and he is the spoiled little boy. And that is my son, that's my kids, and my wife somehow, in all of her grace, manages to keep all of us alive. She is the best. And so there we go. That's a little bit about me. One of the great joys of being a husband and a father is that you get to help dictate the traditions of family. And by help, I mean every once in a while, you get to say, like, hey, I have an idea. Can we do this? And sometimes you get to do it. And that is me. And so Christmas, we have a tradition where every Christmas we get one Christmas Lego set and we get to add to the collection because it's for the kids. So that way we can do a family build thing together. It's for the kids, I promise. Anyway, my daughter was given by a family friend a vintage, quote unquote, vintage Lego castle. It was a Dragon Knight castle that I put together when I was her age, and it's really disheartening to find out that the things that I played with are now considered vintage, but here we are. And so someone had given her a box of Legos, and there was a cardboard cutout of, like, this is the picture of the castle, and I was so excited. I was way more excited than her. And so we sat down and we opened up the box. And I realized 2 things immediately. First of all, there was way more Legos in this box than needed to put together a castle, which meant there's 3 or 4 other Lego sets in here. And I don't know if you've ever put anything of Lego together. That's not great. That doesn't help having 5,000 pieces instead of 1,000 pieces. And then the second thing, which was also problematic, there was no directions. There was just the picture. And I was like, I thought it was going to be a really sweet morning. Instead, it's going to be like a really sweet spring. And so that was my thing. And I was thinking about this again this week as one of the great things that I love to do. I got into ministry, my on-ramp was teaching. I love teaching. It is like the joy and privilege of unwrapping a present of truth with people, alongside with people, and that experience of realization of the world and reality. Like, that is what gets me going in the morning. And then, along the journey of teaching the Bible, I fell in love with shepherding. And shepherding is a rather poetic metaphor for something that is not poetic or rosy in the least. I have fallen in love with sitting across from people and hearing and walking with them in brokenness. I love it. And the older I get, a pastor friend told me, he said, once you get closer to 40, people start taking their really serious stuff. And I just turned 38. And I remember being early 30s and being like, man, I can't wait for people to take me seriously when I'm old. And now I'm older and not old yet. And they say, I wish they hadn't. But also, like, there's a sweetness to it. Like, I love it. And this is what I have found, is that sitting across from people and hearing and being invited into people's addictions, when spouses walk, when there's that little child and they don't know what to do because that little child's getting older and they're like, I don't know how to love them. Or even the jacked upness that is in their own heart. The question that keeps coming up is, how do I change? Like, how do I stop this? How do I become something different? Or how does this person who I dearly love, like I really truly care about them, how do I get them to change? And I think about that Lego set. Because shepherding is oftentimes you feel like you're looking at a broken mess. And because of the sweetness of the Spirit, you get to see a little bit of like, this is what God's design is. This is who the Spirit is creating them to be. And I have no idea. It is so easy to be in the middle of it and to be like, I have no idea how we go from here to here. How do we do that? And some of us this morning, you're right in the middle of it. Like, you came in and you came off a week and you're like, I have got to change. And I have no idea how to move that needle. And others of us, you're looking at people who you love and you're like, they need change. And I have no idea how to love them well in that. And you feel like you're looking at a box of 10,000 Lego pieces. And this is what I love, is that Paul writes down for us in the book of Ephesians, he is writing to friends who are also 10,000 Lego pieces. It's not like we figured out brokenness in 2021, although 2020 made us feel like that sometimes. So here we go. I invite you, flip over in your Bibles to Ephesians chapter 4, and we need to set up a little bit where we are. So we're going to do a really quick review. Paul begins in Ephesians chapter 1 with a wonderful psalm of praise to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the triune God, you might say, and follows that with a prayer for his brothers and sisters in Ephesus. And from that prayer, in chapter 2, Paul speaks to two things that Jesus has done, past tense, in their lives. The first thing is in verses 1 through 10, and he says, you have been, you who were dead. You were without hope. You were enemies of God. You were sons of the prince of the power of darkness. You're like, that's really, really bad. You have been made alive. You have been reconciled vertically with God. Because of God, because of nothing that you have done, because of no accomplishment of your own, hear this, you have been made alive. He has just given you life. You are no longer an enemy of God, but you are a child invited to sit at the table. You did not earn it. It was just handed to you. So the shame, the guilt, if you're a child of God, the shame, the guilt, the stuff that you bear, it's only a product of the lie. It's not on you. He loves you. He has made you alive. He has brought you into his kingdom. He has adopted you as his own. That's what he has done. You have been reconciled. But it gets better. And you're like, well, how can it get better? Because it's not just you living in a hermitage like surrounded and just like God's desire is not for you to just meditate in isolation for the rest of your days. Instead, what God has said is he has brought you into as a citizen of a new kingdom, this new work that he has done. And you're like, but I'm weird. Like I read Dune. That's weird, all right? But no, this is the thing. Your unique story, your background, your culture, your heritage, your family, the unique wounds and personality and wiring that you have, God says through Paul in Ephesians verses 11 through 22, like all of that he has taken from around this world and is building up into a new temple to be a physical representation, because what temples were, in that metaphor, is temples captured the idea of the place where heaven, the place where God dwells, intersects with earth, the place where we dwell. And as you and I, as we love and serve and link arms with one another, you have been, past tense, been built up into this temple, and you are, present tense, being built up into a community of people, brothers and sisters, working alongside one another, submitting to one another in all of our variances and all of our differences. We seek to serve and come alongside because we're part of a family now. You've just been given that. There's no test. There's no immigration process, thank goodness. There is just adoption. And now you're brothers and sisters, whether you like it or not. That's where we are. Right? Chapter 3 ends with Paul's prayer for this new people to grow in their knowledge and their experience of Jesus' boundless, steadfast love. That's what was read this morning, right? And as we step into chapter 4, the first outflow of this really great, wonderful news of what Jesus has done and is doing and building us up is that we would seek unity. If Jesus has done this great work for you and for me, in spite of our profound undeservedness, then it follows that I rightly ought to seek unity at cost for myself. Like I get to lose to be with you because Jesus has lost all to just hand me him. That's what we have, right? That even as we see the second half, the next piece, even as we see a variety of gifts and roles within the people of God, the authority structure within the church does not seek to build up the church for the authority and the apostles, the teachers, and the pastors, and the leaders. The idea is not that the leaders of the church are building up the church so that way the leaders of the church can lead a bigger thing. We're not about our branding, right? Kip's branding is pretty good, but I mean, we're not about that. That was a joke, Kip. Where he made it. What did he say? We're tickled pink. Like how many people can get away with saying that? I love it. But no, like we're not about us. The purpose of the leadership and the gifting of the people on this stage is about serving and coming alongside and coming underneath you. That's what we're here for. And that's not just posturing. We are actually here to call, equip, resource, release, and then celebrate what the Holy Spirit is doing and will do in and through you. Like the way the people of Summit, the way we have said it and continue to say it, is we exist to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel without having to come or go anywhere. Because of you. Man. All right. And that gets us to here. Right? All of this, how great the Father's love, how wonderful Jesus' affection, how boundless the Spirit's work, we can now have peace with those who are not like us at all. And this is, all of this is because of the steadfast love of God. Like, that's what has been iterated time and time again as we have walked through the book of Ephesians. But there is something, if you have grown up in the church, if you've grown up in fundamentalism or evangelicalism, or if you've only witnessed it from the outside, there's this expectation that you have the caricature of the church, the caricature of the religious right, the caricature of God's people is what? They're people who don't drink and don't smoke and don't have romantic relationships with people that do, right? Like, that's what it is to be a Christian, correct? When people find out you're a Christian, it's like, oh, you're one of those holier than thou. You have a list of things that you don't do, and that's what makes you a Christian. You have a list of things that you're against, and a list of practices you're against, and you don't do those things. That's what makes you a Christian. And this is what's fascinating, is you get all the way to this point. You're over half of the way through the book of Ephesians, and that's not Paul's yet to tell people, hey, be a good little boy and girl. And the reason I highlight that is because he is about to shift to talk about morality and to talk to his brothers and sisters. And he's like, you need to change. And this is why this is really critical and why I'm spent so much time on my introduction just to talk about Ephesians chapter 4, is because if you miss the grace of God, if you forget, if we start off in just chapter 4, then you may walk away from this thinking that God's primary desire for your life is that you just be a good person. And that's not it. Chapter 4 is built on God saying time and time again, you are mine. Where are you right now? Some of you, you're like, I'm the box, and I've got two pieces together, and I got nothing else. And Jesus looks at you, and he says, you are mine. And that's where we are. We have to begin with the identity. What Jesus offers you and me is a place at the family table, citizenship, belonging, love. He died just to give it to you. And he's not waiting for you to put the castle together before he grants it. So then the question is asked, so what about morality? Where does this actually come in? I'm so glad you asked. This is where we are. All right, so here we go. Flip over to Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17. This section, this passage is broken up into two parts, really. Here we go. Verse 17. Now this I say and I testify in the Lord. All right. What does that mean? He's saying, like, these are my words, and also these are God's words. This is not my opinion. This is from God himself. That you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. And you're like, all right. Okay, what's going on? If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, let me finish reading this. I'm going to read the whole section here. You must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. He goes harder to the whole. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. They've become callous and they've given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity. All right. If you're not a Christian, if you're new to the church, you're like, that's pretty rough. That's pretty blunt, Paul. Like, I feel like it's a little bit condescending. Well, bear with me, because this is the lens to which you might be hearing it through. Fundamentalism has gotten really good at equating sensuality and impurity with going to hell when you die. Right, so what's the takeaway? If I give myself up to physical desires, or if I do whatever the patriarchy says is impure, then I'm going to go to hell. And if I don't want to go to hell, then I need to do those things. So I need to fix my life. So I need to find out the code. I need to find out the list. And I need to do the list and not do the bad list. And that's not how Paul talks about morality here. Like, it's easy to read it onto the text, but that's not actually the words that he's saying. Outside of Jesus, what are the Gentiles doing? The people who are not God's people, what's he saying? It's from the futility of their minds. Humanity is stumbling in the dark. They're functional outsiders with no experience of what it is to be known and part of the family of God, right? Like, honestly, they don't understand. They don't understand, and because of the difficulty of life, because of the wounds that have been done to them, the nature of just trying to survive, their hearts have grown calloused, right? The whole sensuality and greed thing, this is fascinating. What Paul says, he's like, here's the big problem. They're doing bad things. This is what they did, and this is what you need to stop that. That's not what he says. He's like, listen, why did they do the bad things? It was their coping mechanism to deal with the hardship of life. There is something deeply wrong with people and the destructive choices they make. The places in which people fall short is not the problem. It is evidence of something that is deeply jacked up in here. And it is so easy to slip into, listen, I feel like you're doing this wrong. You're doing this really bad thing. And I think the way to fix you is to remind you of just how bad this thing is for about 30 minutes. And I'm going to harp on that, and I'm going to convince you that this thing is really, really bad, because maybe if you realize that this thing is really, really bad, then you won't do the thing that's really, really bad. And this is the thing. We know it doesn't work. Like, some of you, you're like, I had that, Dad. Like, do we have the same parent? I don't understand. You're like, no. And some of us, we're like, I'm parenting like that, but I have no idea the other way to parent. I just lectured. That's what happened to me, and that's what pastors did to me, and so I guess that's what we do. And that's not what Paul does. He speaks first and foremost to, hey, brothers and sisters in Jesus, do you not remember that when you were doing evil, when you were participating in evil, it wasn't because you were just like, I've got nothing better to do today. It was because you were broken and life was futile and you had no idea what to do. And so you're like, I guess this is what I don't know. And you do it. In three dense sentences, he speaks to a couple things. The first thing he does, as he affirms, your moral responsibility as a human being matters. God doesn't care about your moral performance because he has nothing better to do than to micromanage your life. God cares about your choices in the same way a loving parent gets to participate and cheer on their child when they're making blueberry muffins and they mix up the salt and the sugar. This happened yesterday. And I love my little girl. But also I'm going to be like, listen, little girl, it actually matters that you follow the directions, because if you don't follow the directions, like salty blueberry muffins are not great. And you don't want to live the rest of your life eating salty blueberry muffins. Like, we got to fix the understanding here. Tablespoon, teaspoon, two different things. It really matters. And some of the guys are like, what's the difference? It doesn't have to do with tea. I'll tell you that. This is what matters. God cares about your life actually affecting the world and the people around you for good and not evil. And so the way he's wired this existence is that your choices affect your soul, your choices affect the souls of others, and the world, your choices affect the world. He's like, it matters. You must. He doesn't leave morality up to your whim. Secondly, because when we talk to a people who fall short, be it our roommate, spouse, child, or the internal incessant dialogue that takes place between our own ears, it is the norm for us to fix on the final product of behaviorism and think, this is what I really have to do. And this is what he speaks to. He's like, that's not true. Right? There is a right compassion and empathy to have for people. While not saying evil is not evil, giving yourself up to sensuality and pleasure and to all sorts of things is not good. He doesn't just give them carte blanche, whatever. But he's like, listen, but you don't get there in a vacuum. And this shift is critical because it absolutely determines how we engage the gaps in our own hearts and the gaps in the people that we love, right? I want to speak to this. And this is the third thing, and this is a designated rabbit trail. Maybe this morning you're sitting here and you come to this point and you're like, what Paul is saying here is actually describing my life in this moment. Like, this is where I live. This was this morning. In this, and if you're feeling that in your spirit right now, please hear this. That is not a sign of futility and God's wrath towards you. That is a sign of God's grace that you are even self-aware of your own brokenness. It is evidence in this moment of Jesus's affection for you. It is grace right now in this moment where you're like, there's something wrong. The pricking of the hardness of your heart is a demonstration of his love for you. He actually cares in the midst of all of the stuff and the shame, guilt, and despair. He loves you there. This is what he's inviting you to. This is what he invites us to, and this is what he calls us to. This next verse. But this is not the way you learned Christ. And Paul knows this. Because he was one of the first people to actually present the gospel to the Ephesians. He's writing to his friends in the Ephesian church who he was with for at least 18 months. So he's like, I know for a fact. Well, he's like, when I was there, when I was showing up, I didn't actually say you could just love Jesus, get a ticket to heaven, and then live life however the flip you want. He says, nope, I didn't say that. Those are not my words. This is what I said. He's like, assuming that you have heard about Jesus and were taught in Jesus as the truth is in Jesus. He keeps going back to the person of Jesus. And this statement is not like a conditional, like, well, maybe you're a Christian, maybe you're not a Christian because you've sinned in the past. That's not what he's saying. In the Greek language, it's very clear that this is a hypothetical where the answer is assumed to be yes. Does that make sense? He's like, I know you guys learned about Jesus and you were taught in Jesus. And you met Jesus. And in that, this is what you have heard. To put off your own self, your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through its deceitful desires. All right, what does it sound like he's talking about? He's saying, you have a former life. You have habits, patterns of behavior. You have your very brain chemistry that has been affected by the choices that you have made in the past. That is in your old closet. Keep that stuff there. Some of you have clothes from your college days. Some of you have clothes from your high school days. Some of us we've actually gone to Goodwill and bought clothes from the 90s, which should never have been bought. Austin, I'm talking about you, right? Like, you shouldn't wear that. It should have died. It should have died, and now it's coming back, and you're making a huge mistake. All right, listen. This is the beauty of it, though. Like, what he is saying, it's a lot like my son, August, who's a goober. He's 7 years old, and he is entirely not self-aware yet, even at seven. He came downstairs for dinner. This is supper time. This boy has gone to school. He came downstairs, ate breakfast with his sisters, who say they love him, and a mom who's very busy, and went to school, spent a whole day at school with a teacher that I assume cares about him and classmates that, well, they're also seven. He comes home, does his homework with his mother, and then he comes to the kitchen table, and I look at him, I'm like, hey, buddy, when did you find out your shorts are on backwards? And my son, he looks at me, he's like, he looks down, right now. I'm like, cool, just checking. You want to? I said, you want to go fix that? And he looks at me. He's like, do I have to? I'm like, son, this is the best part though. Like, I wish you could have seen him because he's wearing Teenage Mutant Ninja shorts, and the little logo is supposed to be on this leg, but it's actually like on the back of that leg. And he's wearing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle shorts, and he's wearing a plaid shirt. And I'm like, this nothing. I love you. My daughter's figured it out. My oldest, she's figured out that if she just wears Under Armour, which is a very expensive choice, but it's very thoughtful because if you just wear Under Armour, like literally everything fits. Like everything just goes together, and that's her route. And then Emma is, my fashion-oriented one's wearing all the 90. I'm like, why? I don't even know what that is. But Meyer's my son, all right? Now listen, here's the thing. This is the practice of it. This is what blows my mind, is he just kept rolling with it. I know this is not as it should be. I know this presents poorly. I know this doesn't make sense. I know this doesn't work. And the beauty of Paul's call is, like, take it off. Like, change. Fix it. The thing that you know is incongruent with who you are. Change it. This is the logical, natural progression of life. It belongs to the things that belong to your former manner of life, and it's corrupt through its deceitful desires. Hey, friends, don't let the accuser bring the guilt and shame of what's in the closet to bear on the burden of your soul. The life that was lived, the life that was corrupt, not defending it, you were sold on a lie, and that is not you anymore. This is what the enemy loves to do. He's like, oh, yeah, that addiction, we're looking at pornography today, that's who you were? Yep, you might as well, still there. The alcohol, the anger that you've always had that, this is just who you are. Surrender. There's no point. This is just your identity. I have a very dear friend, Brian Onken, and one of his pet peeves, he has a few pet peeves. He's very precise about language, which is, if you're going to be precise, that's a good thing to be precise on. But it drives him bonkers when pastors look at people who are the children of God and say they're sinners. Not because he doesn't think Christians sin anymore, but because, and I love this, he says, Christians don't need any more accusations to feel like they are, by their identity, bent on sinning against God. You are, if you're a child of God, your identity, your DNA has been rewritten. You are his. Your identity is no longer one who falls short. Your identity is one who is bound up, wrapped in the very righteousness and affection of the Father. That's who you are. Don't carry the lie of the enemy. Paul's looking at his friends with the same bewilderment of a father and with the same affection, and he says, hey, buddy. No, that's not you. He says this, and be renewed, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self. I love this because he speaks to the two ditches that we tend to fall in. The first is the feeling that it's up to me to figure this out and to put the pieces of the thing together. And this is what he says, like, nope, there is absolutely an element to this where you are passive. God himself is participating in the details of your life to work something new inside of you. You're not alone. He's not waiting for you to figure it out. He's not waiting for you to beat this. He's not waiting for you to help yourself so that way he can help you. That's garbage. Instead, what he says is, God is renewing you. There's a degree in which you're passive. And some of us were like, that's really great. I'm just waiting for God to work in my heart so that way life changes easy. That's the other side of the ditch. The other side of the ditch is where you're like, if God really wants me to change, he's just going to make me change. And it'll just be easy. Like, if God really doesn't want me to be angry with my kids and lose my mind on my kids, then I just won't lose my mind on the kids. I'm like, nope, you missed the thing. You wish. God is with you in that, but that doesn't mean making the choice and actually taking something off is something you don't participate in. We feel, like, just like when you're trying to get a toddler to change their the arm in the neck, and you're like, nope. The toddler actually feels their arm pulling out. Be like, oh, it goes here. Oh, that makes more sense. Yep. All right, we feel it. Because God is working in it, means there is hope. It doesn't mean your choice doesn't matter. And we're just there in the dentist chair, and our only responsibility is just to not chew on the poor technician's fingers. Like, he's like, no, like, this is what we do. Right? The mystery of the human experience is that God is infinite. He is outside of space and time. He knows the end from the beginning. He knows the details and the particulars of how you are wired. He knows the fullness of your story. And yet he crafted humanity so that we actively participate in the story as we step into the responsibility that he holds out for us. And in this, hear this, your story has meaning. Your choices matter. Your life and the struggle has significance in the context of eternity. And you're like, well, where do you get that? Because I'm just a person. This, and put on the new self, created, past tense, which is fascinating, created after the likeness of God. Now, if you're one of those people where if you look up your YouTube history, you're like, all of the Easter egg spoiler videos for every single thing and every little nerd video, like, we're of the same cut. But this is an Easter egg, right? Like, for the Jewish readers and for the Gentile readers who are familiar with the Old Testament, this is a neon, like, oh, I know what you're talking about. Because this phrase, created after the likeness of God, is a huge sign of something that was said way, way back. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 28. And what's going on there, in the very creation of the story, at the very beginning of the story, God says, let us make man. This is the purpose. This is the purpose of why we're even starting with people, not because we're bored, but because what we want to do is we want to make man and woman after our image. Literally, the word there is selem, which means idol. And you're like, wait, God made an idol? I don't even understand. Like, no, all right, well, this is kind of the idea, is what does an idol do? An idol is a physical representation in space and time of something that is far grander and more wonderful and more beautiful than that little thing. Does that make sense? Your purpose in life is in a geographical space and time to declare before a broken world who God is. Your life, your choices, the way in which you love your kids, your spouse, your neighbors, your employees, the way in which you handle a world that has lost its mind, the way you carry yourself, the way you use your language, the way in which you respond to evil matters, because in doing so, you declare something about who God is. You don't get to say, it's just my life. No, God gave you the life, and he said, I want you to do something bigger with your life than just live your life. Your 78 years on average matters in the context of eternity because eternal souls are looking at you. You have people around you. You have people around you like you have little souls. If you have little souls called kids, the way in which you respond to sin, they will project onto God. If you respond to the failing of your kids with anger and distance, and you withdraw, guess what your kids project onto God? And some of you know this because you were that kid. The way in which you treat your kids when they fail matters. The way in which you treat your spouse when she fails matters. The way in which you treat your spouse when he fails matters. The way in which you treat your roommate that also had that dad or didn't have a dad at all, and they're like just distant, the way in which you treat them in their wins and failures matters because you're teaching them something about who God is. This is God's design for you in all things, in all moments, in the midst of the mundane, that we would be bearers of his personhood here. Created after the likeness of God. And then he says this, in true righteousness. And we think like righteousness, that just means like I can't go to rated R movies. No, that's not what it means. It means something's far more beautiful. The idea, the Hebrew and Greek, like, idea of righteousness is to do right by someone. that feeling of when you are stepping into a conversation, you're like, this is going to be really tough. And then you step out of the conversation and all parties agree, like, I treated them as they needed to be treated. Not as I wanted to treat them. It's different. There's a difference, guys. Not as I thought they should be treated, but as God called me to treat them. And maybe that means you lose. Probably that means you lose. Because in losing and in loving, in their undeservedness and in their difference, and even in your lack of understanding why they need this, in trusting the Lord and moving to them in that, in very specific, practical ways that feel costly, you demonstrate righteousness. As we demonstrate God's compassion, justice, mercy, and putting on righteousness, we take on the mantle of our purpose declared from the very beginning of time. Your meaning and significance isn't determined or set by your career path. It isn't determined or set by your social economic status. It isn't determined by you fulfilling all of your parents' expectations for yourself. Thank goodness, right? Like, your purpose and meaning and significance in your life is in the details, in the mundane, in the relationships you'd represent God in, where he has placed you. And you get to rest there. And then lastly, when you and I, in holiness, when you and I refrain from the deceitful desires of our flesh, when the world is sprinting one direction, and they're like, you don't want to be on the wrong side of history. That phrase is true. When we refrain from the right wing, when the right wing looks at us and we're like, no, like, that's, you're not us. And when the left wing, when they look at you and you're like, wait, that's not us. When you forsake a democracy for a kingdom and people look at you and you're like, you don't belong, you're different. I thought you were from our tribe, you're not from our tribe. Yeah, that's holiness. I thought you were with us. As we live in step, lockstep with what Jesus is calling us to in all things. And we unite the world by when the world looks at you and you're like, I thought you were with us, but you're not. Yeah, that's holiness. We put on display the otherness of God. Okay, so three things I want to encourage you in. First of all, vertically, take some time today. Today is the Sabbath. There's not much going on. I know there's sports footballs being thrown. So take some time. There's a lot of commercials, and there's halftime. Take advantage of the weather. Go for a walk. Leave your cell phone somewhere else. Pen and paper, or just verbal conversation with the Lord. And I want you to process this. When you are putting on that former manner of life, what is the actual thing going on in your heart? What's the actual gap? What is the truth that you have forgotten? What is the light that the darkness is drowning out? What is the lie that is seeking to subvert the truth of who you are in Jesus? When you are angry, the problem is not you are angry. The problem is in your anger, you are believing something that is not true. What is it? Like, what's the thing? When you get to that point in the evening and you're like, the Spirit, I know the Holy Spirit's telling me to go to sleep. I know I should be going to bed. And I don't. Why not? There's a reason. When you're scrolling through the news and you feel the fear, what's the truth? And do this, like, write it down, and then do this next step, and it is mandatory homework. You're not graded on it, so I guess it's not mandatory, but, like, in love. It's the teacher in me. Do this. Share it with someone you love and trust. And invite them into that conversation. Be like, when I was talking with the Lord, I do this thing. Confess the thing. I do this thing. And I think this is what's happening inside of my heart. Would you walk with me in this? We need this. You're not alone in this. Secondly, horizontally, let us be a people who these truths affect how we shepherd the souls around us. Parents, be about more than behavior modification. Roommates, the super annoying habit that your roommates have, the idiot decision that person on your hall just made, there's more going on. Spouses, that thing, that habit, that practice, there is more going on. There's more God is calling you to than just fixing them. This is my plea. Love the people around you enough to take the inconvenient. It is highly inconvenient to do this, by the way. It's way easier to just yell at them. Take the inconvenient time to sit down with them and to ask them, hey, I love you. What's going on? What's happening? And ask to be a part of their story. Love them enough to listen. And then love them enough to be like, this is who Jesus is. This is how Jesus feels towards you. This is what Jesus has done, is doing, wants to do in you. That's what we need. And then lastly, this is going to be Kyle's favorite. This is what I'm going to get in trouble for. We love you enough to actually walk with you in this. So if you are like, I've got huge things. You said 10,000 pieces. It's more like just a room full of Legos, and I have no idea where even the right pieces are. We love you enough, and this is not just me saying this. If you email me, that's on the website. You should email Kyle first. I'm serious. If you email me like, I want to process this, I will actually meet with you because I love it. I love you. We really, truly, one of the lies of the enemy is that I hear this all the time and it drives me crazy. I have this thing and I've been struggling for a really long time, but I know you're really busy and I didn't want to bother you. I don't think you understand. I get paid to walk with people and stuff. That's what I do. That's my only job. I teach. I teach too, and I send out emails. So I do those things. But if you're like, I want help, yes, we love you. We love you enough to step into your story. Okay. I'm going to invite the band up, and we're going to continue in worship. Because this is the beauty. Wherever you are right now, your insufficiencies, your insecurities, the things where you're like, this is a disaster in my life, the absolute truth, if you're a child of God, and if you're not a child of God, this is what you are being invited into in this moment. This is my prayer. I invite you, bow your heads. This is our prayer. This is my prayer for you. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he might grant you to be strengthened with power through a spirit in your being, so that Christ might dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, might have strength to comprehend with all of the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.